were, but I didn't notice that, but I did get more noise on it. So he said it works best if you're in a quiet area or quiet environment, otherwise don't use it.
Okay, let me ask you, Chris, do you have an RF choke on the transmission line?
I don't. However, I was buying one from him, which is how I got on this conversation. So he asked why I was buying a choke, and I said I have a high noise level. I have a ton, you know, being an ex-IT guy, I have a ton of electronics in my house, and everything's noisy, tons of Chinese stuff, and, you know, with the noisy power supplies. So I was just trying to cut back on the noise, and he asked if I had a counterpoise. And I did, so he said remove it, and I did, and certainly the noise went down. I still have too much noise, but I got to go through and button everything in the house. I just haven't had time to do that, but that's how we got on that subject. So I do have a choke, and I tried with and without. It did make a difference.
Okay, magic question is where'd you put the choke?
I put it pretty close to the radio, which is what he suggested.
Okay. Effectively, you have a counterpoise. The outer surface of your coax cable is operating to a degree common mode. The only way to not have any of that happen is to choke it at the antenna site. So, if you're so inclined, you can experiment with different lengths of placing the choke to see if there's any significant change. Because effectively, what you'd be doing is changing the length of the common mode the counterpoise that is part of a NFET.
Right. I believe he meant something like that. He also asked my whole setup, and he wanted it 6 feet away from the radio or something like that. If I recall, this was like 2 years ago. I think he was telling me he wanted it 6 feet away from the radio, but not too much farther, something like that. But I have really good grounding. I'm basically on the beach here, and a foot in the ground is salt water. And I have a couple of ground rods that go down into it. So I think he said in my situation, my grounding was so well, the counterpoise, you know, wouldn't make a difference. So, you know, your results might be different, in other words. K2SDP.
Okay, I mean, ultimately that's always going to be the case. But, I mean, that's one of the many variables a lot of people don't consider a RF choke at the shack. A actual counterpoise, but that's what kind of nature uses as a counterpoise. If you don't offer it an actual counterpoise itself, it'll simply grab the closest thing, which is usually the outer surface of the shield of your transmission line. So again, it may come to nothing, but someday when you feel highly experimental, when you feel like you're a physicist or something. Move the choke around. See if you get any different characteristics. You know, even if you don't, at least you've learned something.
Thank you, Amzie. By the way, my choke is right at the antenna end or at the 9-1. So, yeah, I do not blow on any RF currents in my shack.
Okay, but I mean, again, it's a kind of a cheap, dirty way of getting a counterpoise. You don't necessarily, as Chris was told, have to put the choke right up to the shack, 6 feet away from the radio. You can experiment with lengths, but, it depends on how you want to work it. If you want to have a proper counterpoise, that's fine. That's another piece of wire. You get a random piece of wire. You see how it works. You fold it back, change the length, see how things change. How you lay the counterpoise is going to have an effect. If you want to go a little bit quick and dirty, again, you could just move the RF choke farther down the transmission line, not really close to your shack, so you're still sparing yourself the common mode current RF. but you kind of get a cheap, really, because it's nothing, cheap counterpoise that's existing in the outer aspect of the shield of your transmission line.
Well, Roy, this is Mike, 82MZ. I guess we haven't heard any of what I was asking for, a semi-specific number. Again, same thing. You ask three different people, you get three different answers. I'm back to what I'm going to be doing, which is basically the RL length, keep cutting back, put my antenna analyzer on and see what I get, and I'll take it from there. That's what I think I'm going to have to do.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mike, as we started this conversation. Unfortunately, there's no delightful equation. There's no simple answer. I've never seen, usually, and you've noticed this, if you Google best lengths for a non-resident NFED, very often you'll get a table with a whole bunch of different numbers that different people have volunteered. So when that happens, and again, you get the kind of the same thing with, you know, if you ask people how many radials for a ground-mounted vertical, you know, some people will tell you 12 and 20 and 36 and 42, and you know, if you ask them, well, how long should the radials be? And most people will give you either something like a quarter of a wave, or you know, a little bit less of that, or a little bit more than that. And again, none of these things, unfortunately, you can find in a textbook with an equation that you can solve. These are all kind of experience types of things, and different environments interact differently. So if you're putting up an NFED non-resident in an area with salty ground, it's going to have different characteristics than if it has a lot of granite, underground. So, unfortunately, as Chris, I think, mentioned, your mileage very well might vary. So you just have to be the tinkerer and experimenter and play around with a bunch of lengths. And if you happen to get a real favorite length, you'll probably post it on some site and it'll be part of another table.
Copy that.
Okay, sure.
I was just hoping I might get some more opinions, but I kind of what I expected, and the old thing, back to the drawing board.
Yes, Alex?
This is a YouTube and radio guy that lives in, he's K4OGO in Rhode Island. On his Twitter that I follow, on September 18th, he did a theoretical gain of counterpoise wires on average terrain versus saltwater terrain graphic, where he says, over terrain by saltwater, any one counterpoise greater than a quarter wavelength give you 6 to 10 decibels of gain. His Twitter's Salty Walt Hudson. At Salty Walt Hudson. It's from 918. Over.
Okay, I'll have to look that up. There are so many people who have done so many calculations that, you know, unfortunately, you never quite know what's kind of gold and what's kind of bronze. This might be completely correct in his particular environment, but there are so many variables that are possible in nature that might not completely translate to everyone's case, and unfortunately most people don't have the inclination or the time to repeat these experiments and offer their results. Science kind of demands and requires people unbiased to do this experiment over again and publish their results and check to see if their numbers correlate with the original experimenter. But amateurs often don't do that. They have their own motivation. Sometimes they'll repeat an experiment, but most times they'll try a different one, just for the heck of it.
Don't forget, when you do an experiment, it's got to be repeatable. If not, these results are invalid.
Well, not only repeatable, but reproducible by other people in other places, because the laws of physics are uniform over space and time. So that's the problem with pseudoscience, you know, when people kind of talk to ghosts. And they say, well, I can't talk to the ghost today because you're giving out negative vibes, or it's a geomagnetic thing and we're in the wrong location. So, yeah, it's always good to check your stuff, but in addition, other people should check your experiment entirely in their own location and see if they get similar results, because a lot of experiments look nice the first time. But when other people try to repeat them, they get other results, which is problematic.
K2STP?
Yes, Chris?
Just one thing, one other thing I wanted to mention to AMC, as you may know, as you may not, I don't know. But I was also told, and I also saw these results, he was dead on, that if you want to test things with the counterpoise and without, make sure the counterpoise is removed like 6 or 7 feet minimum away from the balance. Otherwise, it acts as if it's still connected, which is pretty amazing. But yeah, you have to really bring the wire. So I was disconnecting it and leaving it hanging there like a foot away, and I wasn't seeing a difference with it connected. And then you said, make sure you pull it all the way back. So just keep note of that.
Thank you. Noted. I will definitely do that next weekend when I get a chance. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Yeah, it's capacitively coupling. It's going to capacitively couple with any piece of metal that's nearby the balance. So you have to keep that in mind as well. You know, if you have a run of some kind of other metal, you know, a couple of feet away from the balance, it'll probably couple to one degree or another through it.
And to create the mobile.
Yes. Hello again.
Hi. Thank you for your patience this morning. And I've used the NFET zip for many years, 10 years more at different locations. It works very well. It's the NFET zip, you know, has the counterpoise right alongside on the twin lead. It works really well. That's what I was using up in South Dakota for 3 years continuously, and talked around the world. It was about 60 feet long. The radiating portion was 60 feet long. And, you know, like it has those random, you could go random lengths, but 60, I think 60 and 20, something like that. But it's well documented, you know, different lengths. But it's about 60 feet long, just to say. So the, and the, you always put a lazy balance. Break the RF coming back, you know, between the antenna and the radio. That's just my comment, but I've used it for years and years, different locations. That's the NFET step antenna. Back to that control.
Okay, thank you, Ken. I appreciate it. Mike is kind of looking for something that will let him work 160 meters. So he's looking for a longer piece of wire than that, but that's good advice. I mean, there are a near infinite number of different types of antennas that you know, work under you know, circumstances. But Mike is kind of looking for a random NFED for 160 meters. Again, yeah, I wish you luck, Mike, and you know, it is inherently a compromise. It's I hope you have a good antenna tuner to make it to tune it up correctly, despite the 9-to-1 on them. And please come back and tell us how it worked.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, yes. I do have these tuners. No issue about that at all. I've been wanting to work 160 for a long time. And again, yes, this is going to be a compromised antenna. We all understand that. That's the name of the game. But anyways, I'm not quite finished experimenting. I'll let you know. KG2AMZ.
WA2ZFM.
Yes.
Okay. This is off topic, but I just want to get back to you. I would suggest when you have an opportunity, do a little bit of reading about convection and the stack effect and what the stack effect is. For example, in apartment houses, during the warmer months, the chimney is hot, the buildings are hot. When smoke comes out of their heating system, the smoke rises. During the winter, when the exhaust pipes or whatever they call it, smokestacks, and the building are cold, oftentimes the smoke will be pushed downward because of the stack effect. And also convection has a lot to do with it as well. And Jim pointed out, who was a fire captain, who's an expert, that when asphalt is hot, due to convection, the air will rise. So if there's exhaust coming out of a car and you're riding your bike, as I've done for over 50 years, it tends to make the air rise. The same thing that makes a hot air balloon rise. And when the weather is cold, the air falls and whatever exhaust that comes out of a vehicle may fall. So I think those are the basic elementary areas to explore, the stack effect and convection, rather than for us to sit here and pontificate and try to come up with some bizarre rationale. I think the laws of physics apply, and they're pretty simple.
AD2 to you.
Yes, Alex.
Random comment related to what he just said. I work in apartment towers. The stack effect was explained to me, and the issue you run into it in high-rise apartment towers is in Long Island City, the wind blows so hard, you need to put a sliding door at the front of the elevator bank because the stack effect will shut down your elevators. The air pressure differential will be so much that it'll air out all and shut them down. So that's why they have to put the doors at the entrance to the elevator banks and towers.
So what are you saying by that? I don't understand it. Are you agreeing or disagreeing with what I just said?
I don't know. It's just a different way. I'm not a science guy. The stack effect, that's how it was explained to me in a practical sense in the local New York City area.
Okay. This was explained to me by a captain in the fire department in the city of New York who has, over a very long and courageous career, has encountered these types of situations hundreds of times.
Okay. I personally think everyone is, well, not everyone. One person is kind of kicking that dead horse. No one's pontificating. We just discussed it. No one's going to get a gold medal for answering it correctly because I don't know anyone to kind of ask. But it was an interesting bit of situation that John came up with, and it was an opportunity for people to discuss it and give their comments. And I don't really see that we should spend the latter half of the net kind of just kicking it around this way and that way forever and ever and ever. So I appreciate your efforts, Stu, and you've given your opinion, and they stand, and you're free to have them, and I think we should move on personally.
I have WA2BSM. I have no regrets in moving on. You certainly spent a lot more time talking about antennas, but that's you're running the net, and that's your prerogative. But nonetheless, I don't come on just to be obstructive. I come online to input whatever knowledge I have for what it's worth and nothing more.
Well, that was a weird comment from someone who didn't ID themselves. Okay, and you're free to do so. I mean, I try to have an informal, open net and try for everyone to be friendly. Don't want to start arguments with people. And you said your piece. I said my piece. Everyone said their piece. I kind of really appreciated the opportunity to talk about antennas because, you know, theoretically this is an amateur radio technet. where antennas are amateur radio. But again, we're open to other things, especially because there are unfortunately less and less amateur radio related questions that are brought to the technical net. And if you look around the country, there's very few individual tech net repeater nets that are operating anymore because of that. They just kind of run out of people talking about anything, and they fold. So we're open for anything, but I particularly enjoy when amateur radio-related subjects are brought up.
Okay, well, I believe you're doing a very good job. I've always said that. But I didn't initiate the conversation about the convection and smoke and this and that. I just simply replied. So I was not the initiator. Anyway, everyone's comments are all appreciated because this is where we learn. When we listen to each other, we learn. Thank you for the opportunity. WA2BF.
You are welcome. Once again, I'm AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limewire Technical Net. We're open for business. If anyone has any amateur radio-related questions, please feel free. Hit that push to talk. You give us your first name and your call sign.
Okay, and VHC again, mobile. What comment?
Sure can.
Hi again, everybody from Nebraska. And once again, thank you, Roy, this morning. And it was a beautiful net. A lot of nice commentary, a lot of nice chit chat. The Kings County Amateur Radio Club net this morning on 10 meters. So, the NFED ZEP is actually a lot longer than 60 feet. I was just saying, you know, that's footage I was using. I don't know what frequency they used to use on the radio back in the day with the Zeppelins, but I'm sure it was very low frequency. And I'm sure it was very long, the antenna. And they dragged that off the back of the Zeppelin. But I'm sure it was very long, you know, hundreds and hundreds of feet long. So I think the antenna could be made very long. I was just mentioning it because the counterpoise is stuck right alongside the antenna on the lateral line, you know. I just wanted to make that clear that it doesn't have to be 60 feet. It could be 160 feet. Just wanted to make that, you know, abundantly clear. And here I am driving up the darkened highways of Nebraska watching the sun go down in the west. There it is, 7:24 in the evening, and hand it back to that control.
Okay, very good, Ken. No, I agree with you. I mean, pretty much all antennas, except for some mechanical problems, can be scaled up or down. It's just a matter of the relationship to the wavelength. So, yeah, you could certainly, and I'm sure, as you mentioned, the early Zeppelin antennas probably were operating at even lower frequencies than 160 meters. You know, back then, the reason why amateur radio operators were given the bands, 160, 80, 40, and such, by the naval authority that had control before the FCC ran wavelengths, is because the Navy thought that those bands were worthless. All those upper bands were technologically problematic, and so they didn't want them or need them, and we could have them, which we are very lucky to have.
Oh, point well made. You know, I lived in Europe for quite a while, in Germany particularly. I have a lot of measuring tapes that are in centimeters only, you know, and I find it very useful for measuring antennas directly, not having to convert to inches. And I have a lot of their, reference material for the DARC, the German Amateur Radio Club, DARC, and especially their antenna books. They have completely different antennas that, are very interesting to build. And you don't see any of them in the ARRL handbook. And I find that, you know, and then Radio Society of Great Britain, RSGB, has an excellent handbook also. I kept when I lived over there. And I build antennas from those handbooks. But the German handbook, everything's, you know, in centimeters, as it should be. That's how they're originally done. And I use my German measuring devices, whatever they may be, that I have on hand. to make my measurements. I find it very, very handy. Just a little side note I thought I would share with the net. Back to you, Roy.
Thank you. By the way, Ken, do you have a copy of Ralph Hamill's?
No. Never heard of it. Enlighten me, please.
Ralph Hamill's is an antenna book that they put out in Germany. And recently they went to the trouble of translating it into English and publishing it locally. So I have a copy of Ralph Hamill's antenna book. I have a copy of the Radio Society of Great Britain's antenna book. I'm a member of that so that I can get the Radcom magazine every month. In addition, I have a copy of the ARRL antenna handbook here in the shack.
Oh, very good. Look at you. Nice, nice. Excellent. Hey, most people don't even know about these things. Very good. I read the antenna books in flat out German. It's pretty easy to, you know a little bit rudimentary German. You can figure it out. It's pretty cool. Their books are printed a little differently, you know, and smaller shapes and stuff, different format, but they're nice, you know, and they got pretty cool antennas that you don't see over here. And I enjoy it. I use the antenna from Britain called the Cobweb. You and I spoke about that. C-O-B-B-W-E-B, Cobweb antenna. That's what I spoke to you on the net with this morning. And that's a British antenna. You know, it's a space-saving antenna. Doesn't take up a lot of landscape. So, okay, I'll leave it at that and hand it back to net control. This is N2BHD Mobile.
Okay, very good, Ken, and thank you, as always, for participating, both here and, of course, on the 10-meter net. Anyway, any other questions for tonight, please hit that push to talk. Give me your call sign and your first name. Okay, I guess we don't have any new takers. So, Wes, you have an interesting little set of list of things you want to talk about?
Yes, I do. But I also have a puzzle. Although it looks like it is a very simple answer to it, it is a puzzle. So what do you want? Do you want me to go with the stuff from the lease, or you want me to go with the puzzle?
Well, I don't know. I mean, last week, I think the puzzle was about a philandering Jewish guy in the 18th century. So maybe let's go with the list.
Okay. So, the lease, the cannon wheel. I sent you the video with the hand truck. I mean, it's not a hand truck. It's a forklift that had a very special wheel and could move side, front, and back. The kind of wheel is also called Swedish wheel or Aeon wheel. It consists of a series of rubberized external rollers set on 45 degrees angle to the wheel. So each wheel is independently driven, and the direction of the travel is dependent on the interaction between the direction of each wheel that is driven relative to the others. I wonder if you see the video and have a comment on it.
Yeah, I saw the video. I mean, they're interesting wheels. They're much more expensive, much more complicated, much more likely to break. And so even the presentation kind of explained that in certain circumstances, they are very useful. But as a generic means of using, you know, a wheeled vehicle just for the sake of wheeled vehicles, it's kind of over-engineered for most requirements. It has a kind of ability to go at right angles and such that could be very useful for very, very small areas, maneuvering in tight spots. But, you know, if you're out on the road, you're probably much better off with a normal wheel than with something like a Mecanum wheel.
Yeah, we'll use for the forklifts. It require very tight, that require very tight maneuvering, or say autonomous robots or wheelchairs. It is something that is a very, very handy, but at the same time there is on the slippery surface, it's really tricky. So yes, it is used by military too, but only in certain applications, when they loading and unloading the big transport airplanes. And even though it is not allowed to be used everywhere there. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm not sure if everybody understood how that wheel is made. So you could say a few words about it. The English is much better. Thank you.
Okay, and therein lies the problem with this particular subject, that, you know, the old thing about a picture is worth 1,000 words. And, you know, certainly a video is worth 100,000 words. So it's kind of a, if you don't know it and if you don't want to look it up, it's very difficult to really describe, except that it's a multi-segment ellipsoid type of wheel that is hooked in at a, mounted at a 45-degree angle, and so it has some slippage that allows you to change the wheel's directions. Basically, whether, you know, each individual wheel is separately geared to either go forward or backwards, depending upon how you coordinate the direction of the four separate diagonal wheels, you can have it move forward, back, to the right, and to the left without having to turn any kind of wide corner. And you know, if you really want to know what it truly looks like, then just Google Mecanum wheel. It's M-E-C-A-N-U-M wheel. There's lots of images, but unfortunately, it's kind of difficult to draw an image on the radio.
I think if somebody didn't see the video, you could actually post it if you think it's worth it. It is just amazing. I saw it many times, but it is something that is kind of shocking to the people. So I'm going to move to the next one, the electromagnetic vortex cannon. I sent you also the video. The researchers say that they found a way to create freely propagating vortex ring, like a smoke ring, but with electromagnetic waves. Why does it matter, and why that discovery, what that discovery could be used for? So that is in the video. So the observation of a propagation of free space experiment. 3 months in two radio electromagnetic pulses was explained in the publication that I also sent you for that. So if you have a few words about it.
Gosh, I thought these were your topics. I'm not exactly sure why they're fascinated with a vortex cannon. Vortexes were very popular in the turn of the 20th century. This was a point where most physicists were going crazy because their physics was broken, and they had to explain things that they didn't understand anymore because they had not yet read Einstein's theory of the photoelectric effect and were blissfully unaware of quantum mechanics. And once quantum mechanics came by, most talk of vortex were shelved because they didn't go anywhere. So, you know, vortexes are interesting things, you know, I mean, smoke rings and what have you. So they have discerned a means to generate electromagnetic waves which travel, of course, they're still transverse waves, they're not longitudinal waves, but their path produces vortexes. So they're trying to figure out how they can make them stronger and longer and see, you know, maybe they would have a beneficial effect as far as RF signals of directing it in more efficient ways. There's a lot of questions. As far as I could perceive from the article, there aren't too many answers yet.
So the principle involves utilizing ultra-wide radially polarized conical horn antennas that create a rotating electromagnetic wave structure. It is kind of not easy to explain because we may also talk about the polarization. So similar to circular polarization of the wave, but it's not exactly the same one. So when the antenna emits, it generates an instantaneous pressure difference that forms the vortex rings, which maintain their shape and energy over the long distances. So the uniqueness of the method lies in its ability to produce electromagnetic pulses with a complex topological features. I don't know if it's a proper wording for it, but it's resilience of self-healing properties during the propagation. Now, the application for it, well, it's if you have such a vortex ring directed towards the protesting crowd, then it depends on the frequency. It is an interaction with the physical body of human body of it, so that could be used as a deterrent too. But the frequency has to be very high.
Okay, I mean, these are all kind of blue sky indications. I don't think they've demonstrated any of this yet, but you know, I'm sure their articles generated a little bit more grant money, so they'll go back into the lab and see what they can do. There's also talk of using vortex electromagnetic vortexes to encode data. So, you know, again, it's one of those things that are really too early to even guess of what the ultimate benefit will be. They'll have to take it to the lab and see where the promise meets reality.
KQ2R1.
Yes, David?
I have a question about sound waves, and I don't think it has anything to do with vortex.
Okay, maybe you want to wait after Wes is finished and come on. We'll continue to take questions.
Sure, it sounds fine. KG2RY, standing by. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So by analyzing the unique patterns of the vortex pulses, there is the Chinese scientists were able to find a method for detecting and locating objects, whether in defense system or space exploration. So it's not necessary that to be used as a deterrent for the protesting crowd, but also in your location. So we're going to the next one. It would be how scientists see through the walls using particles from the space. Let me drop.
K2CYR, question please.
Yes, what's your question?
I'm wondering, I get the impression that we've been lectured here. I just wanted to let Prince Welkian know that not everybody listening on this frequency are scientists from MIT and then big colleges. There's some down-to-earth regular high school people that are just regular ham radio operators. And this elaborate explanation and expressions that he uses is at a loss to us. So can you please bring it down to a level where people can understand what he's saying or what he's aiming at? K2CYL, thank you.
Okay, I think you'll find that the next few topics after this one is more at, you know, it's not at Einstein level. It's not quantum mechanics. It's not relativity. Although there's always a place for all things. I kind of like to give a smattering of everything. I understand that, you know, some subjects either don't interest people or they don't know what the people are talking about when they explain them. There shouldn't be that much more of it for the rest of tonight. So hopefully sit back, relax, you know, get a beverage, and hopefully the rest of it will entertain you.
Okay. So let me go through that one. So we have...
Someone is transmitting over you most of the time.
Okay. Hold on.
Limark TechNet tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL repeater.
That time.
I'll appreciate if somebody's on to that. Because
I'm going to finish soon. And there are some people who would understand what I'm talking about.
Subject to change, I would imagine.
Okay. It was trying to make the antenna more into the repeater. So, we have a structural parameter on bunkers or we also see the volcano that might explode, and we want to know how safe it is around us. The use of cosmic muons can help us. That's okay, the material. I want to use other time to go through it. Victoria?
Yes, are you done? I'm a little computer scared.
Yes, I am. I'm just asking, did you have a chance to go through this material?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to upset anyone. I mean, ultimately what it means, the point is that people are using new technology to image ancient places like pyramids. They have used muon imaging to see inside the cavities of large pyramids. Muons are interesting little particles. They're principal particles. They're not made up of anything else. They're in the same class as electrons. There are electrons, and there are things that are about 17 times heavier, which are called tau, and something about 200 times heavier, which is muons. So muons are created in the upper atmosphere when gamma rays and cosmic rays impact onto the surface of our atmosphere, and the impact generates muons. The muons spray across, and they go through the pyramid, and there are detectors capable of detecting muons, and they've been able to detect hidden chambers that were at that point unknown. So that's the story of how scientists see through walls using particles from space.
Yeah, and actually L.W. Alvarez was the one who used, and actually he became an expert in particle detectors. He used the muon he was awarded the Nobel Prize, if I remember, for his work with hydrogen bubble chambers. Yes, he was one. So he was the one who was scanning a Chervin pyramid last year? I'm not sure exactly when it was, last year, 2 years ago. But yes, so it looks like this is really taking up, and I'm not sure how far they went with the detection of the water. But this is interesting in areas of United States where they have a problem with water.
Okay, I'm not really familiar with that aspect. You know, muons have a very, very short half-life. I think it's something like 22 microseconds.
Of course. Optical imaging of muons was used for water detection in the areas they have a problem with water in the United States. So there was the plastic scintillator block that imaged the charge-coupled CCD camera during the irradiation. But they use a very specific form of muon detection. Okay.
And actually, it helped a lot. I remember the time when I was working with USGS in Salt Lake City, Utah. And that was quite interesting. Also for water detection, because underground mines, they had a problem with it. So the Cherenkov light from the positrons could be also used to produce muon decay in the plastic scintillator block, and that technique used to be used. I'm not sure if they use it till today to help people to get the drinking water. So all area of Utah, Nebraska. I'm not sure about the Nebraska, but Utah and Nevada, they have a problem with water. So that method was used, but if you have a few words about it, they, before I go to the next one, please.
No, nothing to add to yours.
So again, the muon tomography is a technique that uses cosmic red muon to generate two or three dimensional images using information contained in the column scattering of the muons. But going to the next one, that would be something. We have a stem cells reverse woman diabetics. So for the people who have diabetics, the first, second, and the third type of it, diabetics, I'm not sure how to say it properly. So Chinese were able, I said it today to you, so I'm not sure if you were able to see those articles, but you know about it. So the first person which had a reverse diabetes, and now she is diabetes free. She can produce its own insulin in after the treatment, Dr. Ray.
AC2GS, okay. There's a bunch of little problems here. One is it's a Chinese research study, so you always got to look real closely, because they've been known to fake stuff. That's one thing. Number two, the big question is how long will it work? It's not like this has been going on for a couple of years and she's remained not requiring any medication for her diabetes. There's only two types of diabetes. There's type 1 and type 2. Type 1, it used to be called child onset diabetes, but adults have been getting it. It's considered an autoimmune disorder. Your body decides that that your islet cells that produce insulin are against you, and they kill off insulin production. So this principle is the Chinese took some stem cells from the woman and somehow caused it to revert back to pancreatic islet cells, which are the things that make insulin, and implanted those into the person. For some odd reason, they decided, even though they were native stem cells from the patient, she's on she's on medication to not reject the stem cells. Now, the reason why she happens to be on that medication is because she also has a transplanted liver, so that complicates the situation. So she's on medication to block her immune system from rejecting the stem cells, which shouldn't need it. I don't know about that, and we don't know how long, if it stops working, how long does it work, and is it effective? You know, if it gives people the ability to stop needing to inject insulin for 3 or 4 months, is it worth the trouble of a stem cell growing and surgical implanting and such. So there's still a heck of a lot of questions around, do you need medication to be on medication the rest of your life so you don't reject the stem cells? And if you do or if you don't, how long does this graft last before it gives out? Because you still have the autoimmune disorder, although you're blocking it with the medication. So it's confusing. It requires, again, a lot more research.
In the example from the article, the 25-year-old woman with type 1 diabetes started producing her own insulin less than 3 months after receiving transplant of programmed stem cells. So it's actually the programming of the cells that helps the person to regain the health. And she's the first person with the disease to be treated using cells that were extracted from her own body. So it's not that the donor is needed. It's not needed any longer. Dr. Wright.
Yeah, that's what the story is. Hopefully it is correct. But again, you have her on immune, medication to block any immune response. So you don't know for a fact if because you, despite the fact that you took the patient's own stem cells, would they have an autoimmune, they already started off with an autoimmune disorder. So you would kind of think that if they weren't taking medication to protect their transplanted liver, their immune system would probably kill the stem cells. So it's not a really good experiment because it's confusing a whole bunch of things. It would be interesting to know if a person who had their own stem cells implanted in them would continue to produce insulin if they weren't on immunosuppressant drugs. That's a real important thing. Otherwise, you're now stuck with giving these people these immune suppressants for the rest of their lives, which puts them at risk of future infections that they'll have a problem fighting off. So it would be nice if they picked a person who wasn't on immunosuppressants to begin with.
Yeah, actually, that article talks about the insulin-producing islets into the liver of 59-year-old man with a type 2 diabetes. And they also delivered the reprogrammed stem cells taken from the man's own body as he has since stopped taking insulin. But there is no word about the tablets, any kind of medication that should be continuously taken.
I think the woman had her own stem cells. The man had someone else's stem cells, and he's on immunosuppressants as well. So, again, things are a little confusing here. Are you going to be able to get away without immunosuppressants? That would be the best option because that wouldn't put you at risk for any kind of greater possibility of infectious diseases. So it's kind of it's an unknown because you can't stop the lady's immunosuppressants to test whether the stem cells will work because it'll kill her transplanted liver. So that's outside the venue of this experiment. They're going to have to try other people who hopefully are not in need of immunosuppressants to begin with to see if stem cells made from from their own body will let you get away without immunosuppressants and without the increased risk of infections and such.
CT2RY, CAF2CT.
Yes, David first.
Tell me, Roy, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. You know, is it a good idea for people to obsess medicine and hospitals and doctor's offices and treatments and all, if they somehow keep their mind out of it, they stay out of trouble. Do you agree?
Well, the short answer is no. The longer answer is more complicated. It's not good to be a little